ugly Afghan-American, Idris thinks, tearing through the war-torn city like he belongs here, backslapping locals with great bonhomie and calling them brother, sister, uncle, making a show of handing money to beggars from what he calls the Bakhshish Bundle, joking with old women he calls mother, and talking them into telling their story into his camcorder as he strikes a woe-begone expression, pretending he is one of them, like he has been here all along, like he wasn't lifting at goals in San Jose, working on his pecs and abs, when these people were getting shelled, murdered, raped. It's hypocritical and distasteful, and it astonishes Idris that no one seems to see through this act. It isn't true what he told you, Idris says. We came here to reclaim the house that belonged to our fathers. That's all, nothing else. Ambrose snorts a chuckle. Of course I know. You think I was fooled? I've done business with warlords and Taliban in this country. I have seen everything. Nothing can give me shock. Nothing. Nobody can fool me.
I imagine that's true.
You're honest, she says. At least you're honest.
I just think these people, everything they've been through, we should respect them. By we, I mean people like Timur and me. The lucky ones, the ones who weren't here when the place was getting bombed to hell. We are not like these people. We shouldn't pretend we are. The stories these people have to tell, we are not entitled to them.
I'm rambling.
Rambling?
I'm not making sense.
No, I understand, she says. You say their stories, it is gift they give you.
A gift, yes. They sip some more wine. They talk for some time. For Idris, the first genuine conversation he has had since arriving in Kabul, free of the subtle mocking, the vague reproach he has sensed from the locals, the government officials, those in the aid agencies. He asked about her work, and she tells him that she has served in Kosovo with the UN, in Rwanda after the genocide, Colombia, Burundi too. She has worked with child prostitutes in Cambodia. She has been in Kabul for a year now, her third stint, this time with a small NGO, working at the hospital and running a mobile clinic on Mondays. Married twice, divorced twice, no kids. Idris finds it hard to guess at Amra's age, though likely she is younger than she looks. There is a fading shimmer of beauty, a rough-shot sexuality behind the yellowing teeth, the fatigue pouches under the eyes. In 4, maybe 5 years, Idris thinks, that too will be gone. Then she says,
you want to know what happened to Roshi?
You don't have to tell, he says.
You think I'm drunk?
Are you?
Little bit, she says. But you are honest guy.
She taps him on the shoulder gently and a little playfully.
You ask to know for right reasons. For other Afghans like you, Afghans coming from West? It is like, how do you say, stretching the neck?
Rubbernecking.
Yes.
Like pornography.
But maybe you are a good guy. If you tell me,
he says,
I will take it as a gift.
So she tells him. Roshi lived with her parents, 2 sisters, and her baby brother in a village 1/3 of the way between Kabul and Bagram. One Friday last month, her uncle, her father's older brother, came to visit. For almost a year, Roshi's father and uncle had had a feud over the property where Roshi lived with her family, property which the uncle felt belonged rightfully to him, being the older brother, but which his father had passed to the younger and more favored brother. The day he came, though, all was well. He say he want to end their fight. In preparation, Roshi's mother had slaughtered 2 chickens, made a big pot of rice with raisins,
bought fresh pomegranates from the market. When the uncle arrived, he and Roshi's father kissed and embraced. Roshi's father hugged his brother so hard, his feet lifted off the carpet. Roshi's mother wept with relief. The family sat down to eat. Everyone had seconds and thirds. They helped themselves to the pomegranates. After that, there was green tea and small toffee candies. The uncle then excused himself to use the outhouse. When he came back, he had an axe in his hand. "The kind for chopping tree," Amra says. The first one to go was Roshi's father. Roshi told me her father never even knew what happened. He didn't see anything. A single strike to the neck from behind. It nearly decapitated him. Roshi's mother was next. Roshi saw her mother try to fight, but several swings to the face and chest, and she was silenced. By now the children were screaming and running. The uncle chased after them. Roshi saw one of her sisters make a run for the hallway, but the uncle grabbed her by the hair and wrestled her to the ground. The other sister did make it out to the hallway. The uncle gave chase, and Roshi could hear him kicking down the door to the bedroom. The screams, then the quiet. So Roshi, she decided to escape with the little brother. They ran out of the house. They ran for front door, but it is locked. The uncle, he did it, of course. They ran for the yard, out of panic and desperation, perhaps forgetting that there was no gate in the yard. No way out, the walls too tall to climb. When the uncle burst out of the house and came for them, Roshi saw her little brother, who was 5, throw himself into the tandoor, where only an hour before his mother had baked bread. Roshi could hear him screaming in the flames when she tripped and fell. She turned onto her back in time to see blue sky and the axe whooshing down. And then nothing. Amra stops. Inside, Leonard Cohen sings a live version of Who by Fire. Even if he could talk, which he cannot at the moment, Idris wouldn't know the proper thing to say. He might have said something, some offering of impotent outrage. If this had been the work of Taliban or Al-Qaeda or some megalomaniacal Mujahideen commander. But this cannot be blamed on Hekmatyar or Mullah Omar or Bin Laden or Bush and his war on terror. The ordinary, utterly mundane reason behind the massacre makes it somehow more terrible and far more depressing. The word senseless springs to mind, and Idris thwarts it. It's what people always say. A senseless act of violence. A senseless murder. As if you could commit sensible murder. He thinks of the girl, Roshi, back at the hospital, curled up against the wall, her toes knotted, the infantile look on her face, the crack in the crown of her shaved head, the fist-sized mass of glistening brain tissue leaking from it, sitting on her head like the knot of a 6 turban. "She told you the story herself?" he finally asks. Amra nods heavily. "She remembers very clearly. Every detail, she can tell you every detail. I wish she can forget because of the bad dreams." "The brother, what happened to him?"
"Too many burns."
"And the uncle?" Amra shrugs.
"They say be careful,"
she says.
"In my job, they say be careful, be professional. It's not a good idea to get attached, but Roshi and me..."
The music suddenly dies. Another power outage. For a few moments, all is dark, save for the moonlight. Idris hears people groaning inside the house. Halogen torches promptly come to life.
"I fight for her,"
Amra says. She never looks up.
I don't stop.
The next day, Temur rides with Germans to the town of Istalif, known for its clay pottery.
You should come.
I'm going to stay in and read,
Idris says.
You can read in San Jose, bro. I need the rest. I might have had too much to drink last night.
After the Germans pick up Temur, Idris lies in bed for a while, staring at the faded 60s-era advertising poster hanging on the wall. A quartet of smiling blonde tourists hiking along Badnamir Lake, a relic from his own childhood here in Kabul, before the wars, before the unraveling. Early afternoon, he goes for a walk. At a small restaurant, he eats kebab for lunch. It's hard to enjoy the meal with all the grimy young faces peering through the glass watching him eat. It's overwhelming. Idris admits to himself that Temur is better at this than he is. Temur makes a game of it, like a drill sergeant. He whistles and makes the beggar kids queue up, whips out a few bills from the bakhshish bundle. As he hands out the bills, one by one, he clicks his heels and salutes. The kids love it. They salute back. They call him Kaka. Sometimes they climb up his legs. After lunch, Idris catches a taxi and asks to be taken to the hospital. But stop at the bazaar first, he says. Carrying the box, he walks down the hallway, past graffiti-spangled walls, rooms with plastic sheeting for doors, a shuffling barefoot old man with an eye patch, patients lying in stifling hot rooms with missing light bulbs. A sour body smell everywhere. At the end of the hallway, he pauses at the curtain before pulling it back. He feels a lurch in his heart when he sees the girl sitting on the edge of the bed. Amra is kneeling before her, brushing her small teeth. There's a man sitting on the other side of the bed, gaunt, sunburned, with a rat's nest beard and stubbly dark hair. When Idris enters, the man quickly gets up, flattens a hand against his chest, and bows. Idris is struck again by how easily the locals can tell he is a westernized Afghan, how the whiff of money and power affords him unwarranted privilege in this city. The man tells Idris he is Roshi's uncle, from the mother's side.
You're back, Amra says,
dipping the brush into a bowl of water.
I hope that's okay.
Why not? She says. Idris clears his throat.
Salam, Roshi.
The girl looks to Amra for permission. Her voice is a tentative high-pitched whisper.
Salam.
I brought you a present. Idris lowers the box and opens it. Roshi's eyes come to life when Idris takes out the small TV and VCR. He shows her the four films he has bought. Most of the tapes at the store were Indian movies, or else action flicks, martial arts films, with Jet Li, Jean-Claude Van Damme, all of Steven Seagal's pictures. But he was able to find E.T., Babe, Toy Story, and the Iron Giant. He has watched them all with his own boys back home. In Farsi, Amra asks Roshi which one she wants to watch. Roshi picks The Iron Giant. You'll love that one, Idris says. He finds it difficult to look at her directly. His gaze keeps sliding toward the mess on her head, the shiny clump of brain tissue, the crisscrossing network of veins and capillaries. There is no electric outlet at the end of this hallway, and takes Amra some time to find an extension cord. But when Idris plugs in the cord and the picture comes on, Roshi's mouth spreads into a smile. In her smile, Idris sees how little of the world he has known. Even at 35 years of age, its savageness, its cruelty, the boundless brutality. When Amra excuses herself to go see other patients, Idris takes a seat beside Roshi's bed and watches the movie with her.
The uncle is a silent, inscrutable presence in the room. Halfway through the film, the power goes out. Roshi begins to cry, and the uncle leans over from his chair and roughly clutches her hand. He whispers a few quick, terse words in Pashto, which Idris does not speak. Roshi winces and tries to pull away. Idris looks at her small hand, lost in the uncle's strong, white-knuckled grasp. Idris puts on his coat.
I'll come back tomorrow, Roshi, and we can watch another tape if you like. You want that?
Roshi shrinks into a ball beneath the covers. Idris looks at the uncle, pictures what Timur would do to this man. Timur, who, unlike him, has no capacity to resist the easy emotion.
Give me 10 minutes alone with him, he'd say.
The uncle follows him outside. On the steps, he stuns Idris by saying,
I am the real victim here, Sahib.
He must have seen the look on Idris's face because he corrects himself and says,
Of course she is the victim, but I mean I am a victim too. You see that, of course you are Afghan, but these foreigners, they don't understand.
I have to go, Idris says.
I am a mazdoor, a simple laborer. I earn $1, maybe $2 on a good day, Sahib, and I already have 5 children of my own. One of them blind. Now this,
he sighs.
I think to myself sometimes, God forgive me, I say to myself, maybe Allah should have let Roshi, well, you understand, it might have been better, because I ask you, Sahib, what boy would marry her now? She will never find a husband. And then who will take care of her? I will have to. I will have to do it forever.
Idris knows he has been cornered. He reaches for his wallet.
Whatever you can spare, Sahib. Not for me, of course, for Roshi.
Idris hands him a pair of bills. The uncle blinks, looks up from the money. He begins to say,
To...
then clamps his mouth shut, as though worried that he will alert Idris to a mistake. Buy her some decent shoes, Idris says, walking down the steps.
Allah bless you, Sahib!
The uncle calls out behind him.
You are a good man! You are a kind and good man!
Idris visits the next day, and the day after that. Soon it becomes a routine, and he is at Roshi's side every day. He comes to know the orderlies by name, the male nurses who work the ground floor, the janitor, the underfed Thai-looking guards at the hospital gates. He keeps the visits as secret as possible. On his calls overseas, he has not told Nahil about Roshi. He does not tell Timur where he is going either, why he isn't joining him on the trip to Pakman, or for a meeting with an official of the Ministry of Interior. But Timur finds out anyway.
Good for you, he says. It's a decent thing you are doing.
He pauses before adding,
Tread carefully, though.
You mean stop visiting?
We leave in a week, bro. You don't want to get her too attached to you.
Idris nods. He wonders if Timur may not be slightly jealous of his relationship with Roshi. Perhaps even resentful that he, Idris, may have robbed him of a spectacular opportunity to play hero. Timur emerging in slow motion from the blazing building holding a baby, the crowd exploding in a cheer. Idris is determined not to let Timur parade Roshi in that way. Still, Timur is right. They're going home in a week, and Roshi has started calling him Kaka Idris. If he arrives late, he finds her agitated. She ties her arms around his waist, a tide of relief washing over her face. His visits are what she looks forward to most.
she has told them. Sometimes she clutches his hand with both of hers as they watch a tape. When he is away from her, he thinks often of the faint yellow hairs on her arms, her narrow hazel eyes, her pretty feet, her rounded cheeks, the way she cups her chin in her hands as he reads her one of the children's books he has picked up from a bookstore near the French Lycée. A few times he has allowed himself to fleetingly imagine what it would be like to bring her to the U.S., how she would fit in with his boys, Zabi and Lamar, back home. This last year, he and Nahil had talked about the possibility of a third child. What now? Amra says the day before he's scheduled to leave. Earlier that day, Roshi had given Idris a picture, pencil drawn on a sheet of hospital chart paper, of two stick figures watching a television. He had pointed to the one with long hair. This is you? And that one is you, Kaka Idris. You had long hair then, before. My sister brushed it every night. She knew how to do it so it didn't hurt. She must have been a good sister. When it grows back, you can brush it. I think I would like that. Don't go, Kaka. Don't leave. She is a sweet girl, he says to Amra. And she is, well-mannered and humble too. With some guilt, he thinks of Zabi and Lamar back in San Jose, who have long professed their dislike of their Afghan names, who are fast turning into little tyrants, into the imperious American children that he and Nahil had vowed they would never raise. She is a survivor, Amra says. Yes. Amra leans against the wall. A pair of orderlies rush past them pushing a gurney. On it lies a young boy with blood-soaked bandages around his head and some kind of open wound on his thigh. Other Afghans from America or from Europe, Amra says. They come and take picture of her. They take video. They make promises. Then they go home and show their families. Like she's a zoo animal. I allow it because I think maybe they will help. But they forget. I never hear from them. So I ask again, what now? The operation she needs, he says. I want to make it happen. She looks at him hesitantly. We have a neurosurgery clinic in my group. I will speak to my chief. We will make arrangements to fly her over to California and have the surgery. Yes, but the money. We will get the funding. Worst come to worst, I will pay for it. Out of wallet? He laughs. The expression is out of pocket, but yes. We have to get uncle's permission. If he ever shows up again. The uncle hasn't been seen or heard from since the day Idris gave him $200. Amra smiles at him. He has never done anything like this. There's something exhilarating, intoxicating, euphoric even, in throwing himself headlong into this commitment. He feels energized. It nearly takes his breath away. To his own amazement, tears prickle his eyes. Hawala, she says. Thank you. She stands on tiptoes and kisses his cheek. Banged one of the Dutch girls, Temur says. From the party? Idris lifts his head off the window. He had been marveling at the soft brown peaks of the tightly packed Hindu Kush far beneath. He turns to look at Timur in the aisle seat. The brunette popped half a vitamin V and rode her straight to the morning call for prayer. Jesus, will you ever grow up? Idris says, irked that Timur has burdened him again with knowledge of his misconduct, his infidelity, his grotesque frat boy antics. Timur smirks. Remember, cousin, what happens in Kabul? Please don't finish that sentence. Timur laughs.
Somewhere in the back of the plane, there is a little party going on. Someone is singing in Pashto. Someone tapping on the styrofoam plate like a tamboro.
I can't believe we ran into old Nabi,
Temur mutters.
Jesus.
Idris fishes the sleeping pill he had been saving from his breast pocket and dry swallows it.
So I'm coming back next month,
Temur says, crossing his arms, shutting his eyes.
Probably take a couple more trips after that, but we should be good.
You trust this guy, Farouk?
Fuck no, it's why I'm coming back.
Farouk is the lawyer Temur has hired. His specialty is helping Afghans who have lived in exile reclaim their lost properties in Kabul. Timur goes on about the paperwork Farouk will file. The judge he's hoping will preside over the proceedings, a second cousin of Farouk's wife. Idris rests his temple once more against the window, waits for the pill to take effect.
Idris?
Timur says quietly.
Yeah? Sad chat we saw back there, huh? You're full of startling insight, bro.
Yep, Idris says.
1,000 tragedies per square mile, man.
Soon, Idris's head begins to hum, and his vision blurs. As he drifts to sleep, he thinks of his farewell with Roshi, him holding her fingers, saying they would see each other again. Her sobbing softly, almost silently, into his belly. On the ride home from SFO, Idris recalls with fondness the many chaos of Kabul's traffic. It's strange now to guide the Lexus down the orderly, pothole-free southbound lanes of the 101. The always helpful freeway signs, everyone so polite, signaling, yielding. He smiles at the memory of all the daredevil adolescent cabbies with whom he and Temur entrusted their lives in Kabul. In the passenger seat, Nahil is all questions.
Was Kabul safe? How was the food? Did he get sick? Did he take pictures and videos of everything?
He does his best. He describes for her the shell-blasted schools, the squatters living in the roofless buildings, the beggars, the mud, the fickle electricity. But it is like describing music. He cannot bring it to life. Kabul's vivid, arresting details. The bodybuilding gym amid the rubble, for instance. A painting of Schwarzenegger on the window. Such details escape him now. And his descriptions sound to him generic, insipid, like those of an ordinary AP story. In the backseat, the boys humor him and listen for a short while, or at least pretend to. Idris can sense their boredom. Then Zabi, who is 8, asks Nahil to start the movie. Lamar, who is 2 years older, tries to listen a little longer. But soon Idris hears the drone of a racing car from his Nintendo DS.
What's the matter with you boys?
Nahil scolds them.
Your father's come back from Kabul. Aren't you curious? Don't you have questions for him?
It's all right, Idris says. Let them. But he is annoyed with their lack of interest, their blind ignorance of the arbitrary genetic lottery that has granted them their privileged lives. He feels a sudden rift between himself and his family, even Nahil, most of whose questions about his trip revolve around restaurants and the lack of indoor plumbing. He looks at them accusingly now, as the locals must have looked at him when he first arrived in Kabul.
I'm famished, he says.
What do you feel like?
Nahil says.
Sushi, Italian, there is a new deli over by Oak Ridge.
Let's get Afghan food, he says. They go to Abe's Kebab House over on the east side of San Jose near the old Berryessa flea market. The owner, Abdullah, is a gray-haired man in his early 60s, with a handlebar mustache and a strong-looking hands. He is one of Idris's patients, as is his wife.
Abdullah waves from behind the register when Idris and his family enter the restaurant. Abe's Kebab House is a small family business. There are only 8 tables, sheathed by often sticky vinyl covers, laminated menus, posters of Afghanistan on the walls, an old soda machine, a merchandiser in the corner. Abdullah greets the guests, runs the register, cleans. His wife Sultana is in the back. She is the one responsible for the magic. Idris can see her now in the kitchen, stooped over something, her hair stuffed up under a net cap, her eyes narrowed against the steam. She and Abdullah had married in Pakistan in the late 70s. They have told Idris, after the communists take over back home. They were granted asylum in the U.S. in 1982, the year their daughter Pari was born. She is the one taking their orders now. Pari is friendly and courteous, has her mother's fair skin, and the same shine of emotional sturdiness in her eyes. She also has a strangely disproportionate body, slim and dainty up top, and weighed below the waist by wide hips, thick thighs, and big ankles. She's wearing now one of her customary loose skirts. Idris and Nahil order lamb with brown rice and bulani. The boys settle for chapli kebabs, the closest thing to hamburger meat they can find on the menu. As they wait for their food, Zabi tells Idris that his soccer team has made the finals. He plays right wing. The match is on Sunday. Lamar says he has a guitar recital on Saturday. "What are you playing?" Idris asks sluggishly, feeling jet lag kicking in.
"Paint the Black."
"Very cool."
"Not sure you have practiced enough," Nahil says with cautious reprimand. Lamar drops the paper napkin he has been rolling.
"Mom, really? Do you see what I go through every day? I have so much to do."
Midway through the meal, Abdullah comes over to them to say hello, wiping his hands on the apron tied around his waist. He asks if they like the food, whether he can get them anything. Idris tells him that he and Timur have just returned from Kabul.
"What is Timurjan up to?"
Abdullah asks.
"To no good as always."
Abdullah grins. Idris knows how fond he is of Timur. "And how is the kebab business?"
Abdullah sighs.
"Dr. Bashiri, if I ever want to put a curse on someone, I say, may God give you a restaurant."
They share a brief laugh with Abdullah. Later, as they are leaving the restaurant and climbing into the SUV, Lamar says,
"Dad, does he give free food to everyone?"
"Of course not," Idris says.
"Then why wouldn't he take your money?"
"Because we are Afghans, and because I am his doctor,"
Idris says, which is only partially true. The bigger reason, he suspects, is that he is Timur's cousin. And it was Timur who had years earlier lent Abdullah the money to open the restaurant. At the house, Idris is surprised at first to find the carpets ripped from the family room and foyer, nails and wooden boards on the stairs exposed. Then he remembers that they were remodeling, replacing carpets with hardwood, white planks of cherry in a color the flooring contractor had called copper kettle. The cabinet doors in the kitchen have been sanded down, and there is a gaping hole where the old microwave used to sit. Nahil tells him she is working half a day on Monday, so she can meet in the morning with the flooring people and Jason.
Jason?
Then he remembers Jason Spear, the home theater guy. He's coming in to take measurements. He has already got us the subwoofer and the projector at a discount. He's sending 3 guys to start work on Wednesday.
Idris nods. The home theater had been his idea, something he had always wanted. But now it embarrasses him. He feels disconnected from all of it. Jason Spear, the new cabinets, and copper kettle floors. His kids' $160 high tops. The chenille bedspreads in his room. The energy with which he and Nahil has pursued these things. The fruits of his ambitions strike him as frivolous now.
They remind him only of the brutal disparity between his life and what he had found in Kabul.
What's the matter, honey?
Jet lag, Idris says.
I need a nap.
On Saturday, he makes it through the guitar recital. On Sunday, through most of Zabi's soccer match. During the second half, he has to steal away to the parking lot, sleep for a half hour. To his relief, Zabi doesn't notice. Sunday night, a few of the neighbors come over for dinner. They pass around pictures of Idris's trip and sit politely through the hour of video of Kabul that, against Idris's wishes, Nahil insists on playing for them. Over dinner, they ask Idris about his trip, his views on the situation in Afghanistan. He sips his mojito and gives short answers.
I can't imagine what it's like there, Cynthia says.
Cynthia is a Pilates instructor at the gym where Nahil works out. Kabul is, Idris searches for the right words, 1,000 tragedies per square mile.
Must have been quite the culture shock going there.
Yes, it was. Idris doesn't say that the real culture shock has been in coming back. Eventually, talk turns to a recent rash of mail theft that has hit the neighborhood. Lying in bed that night, Idris says, do you think we have to have all this?
All this?
Nail says. He can see her in the mirror, brushing her teeth by the sink. All this stuff.
No, we don't need it, if that's what you mean,
she says. She spits in the sink, gargles. You don't think it's too much, all of it?
We worked hard, Idris. Remember the MCATs, the LSATs, medical school, law school, the years of residency? No one gave us anything. We have nothing to apologize for.
For the price of that home theater, we could have built a school in Afghanistan. She comes into the bedroom and sits on the bed to remove her contacts. She has the most beautiful profile. He loves the way her forehead hardly dips where her nose begins, her strong cheekbone, her slim neck.
Then do both,
she says, turning to him, blinking back eye drops.
I don't see why you can't.
A few years ago, Idris had discovered that Nahil was supporting a Colombian kid named Miguel. She has said nothing to him about it, and since she was in charge of the mail and their finances, Idris had not known about it for years until he had seen her one day reading a letter from Miguel. The letter had been translated from Spanish by a nun. There was a picture, too, of a tall, wiry boy standing outside a straw hut, cradling a soccer ball. Nothing behind him but gaunt-looking cows and green hills. Nahil had started supporting Miguel when she was in law school. For 11 years now, Nahil's checks had quietly crossed paths with Miguel's pictures and his thankful, non-translated letters. She takes off her rings.
So what is this? You got a case of survivor's guilt over there?
I just see things a little differently now.
Good, put that to use then, but quit the navel-gazing.
Jet lag robs him of sleep that night. He reads for a while, watches part of a West Wing rerun downstairs, ends up at the computer in the guest bedroom Nahil has turned into an office. He finds an email from Amra. She hopes that his return home was safe and that his family is well. It has been raining angrily in Kabul, she writes, and the streets are packed with mud up to the ankles. The rain has caused flooding, and some 200 families had to be evacuated by helicopter in Somali, north of Kabul. Security has been tightening because of Kabul's support of Bush's war in Iraq and expected reprisals from Al-Qaeda. Her last line reads, "You have talked with your boss yet?" Below Amra's email is pasted a short paragraph from Roshi, which Amra has transcribed. It reads,
Salam, Kaka Idris. Inshallah you have arrived safely in America. I'm sure that your family is very happy to see you. Every day I think about you.
every day I'm watching the films you bought for me. I like them all. It makes me sad that you are not here to watch with me. I'm feeling good, and Amrajan is taking good care of me. Please say salam to your family for me. Inshallah, we will see each other soon in California. With my respects, Roshana.
He answers Amra, thanks her, writes that he is sorry to hear about the flooding. He hopes the rains will abate. He tells her that he will discuss Roshi with his chief this week. Below that, he writes,
Salam Roshi John. Thank you for your kind message. It made me very happy to hear from you. I too think about you a lot. I've told my family all about you, and they are very eager to meet you, especially my sons, Zabijan and Lamarjan, who ask a lot of questions about you. We all look forward to your arrival. I send you my love. Kaka Idris.
He logs off and goes to bed. On Monday, a pile of phone messages greets him when he enters his office. Prescription refill requests spill from the basket, awaiting his approval. He has over 160 emails to sift through, and his voicemail is full. He peruses his schedule on the computer and is dismayed to see overbooks, squeezes, as the doctor called them, inserted into his time slots all week. Worse, he will see the dreaded Mrs. Rasmussen that afternoon, a particularly unpleasant, confrontational woman with years of vague symptoms that respond to no treatment. The thought of facing her hostile neediness makes him break into sweat. And last, one of the voicemails is from his chief, Joan Schaefer, who tells him that a patient he had diagnosed with pneumonia just before his trip to Kabul turned out to have congestive heart failure instead. The case will be used next week for peer review, a monthly video conference watched by all the facilities during which mistakes by physicians who remain anonymous are used to illustrate learning points. The anonymity doesn't go very far, Idris knows. At least half the people in the room will know the culprit. He feels the onset of a headache. He falls woefully behind schedule that morning. An asthma patient walks in without an appointment and needs respiratory treatments and close monitoring of his peak flows and oxygen saturation. A middle-aged executive, whom Idris last saw 3 years before, comes in with an evolving anterior myocardial infarction. Idris cannot start lunch until halfway through the noon hour. In the conference room where the doctors eat, he takes hurried bites of dried turkey sandwich as he tries to catch up with notes. He answers the same questions from his colleagues. Was Kabul safe? What do Afghans there think of the U.S. presence? He gives economical, clipped replies. His mind on Mrs. Rasmussen, on voicemails that need answering, refills he has yet to approve, the 3 squeezes in his schedule that afternoon, the upcoming peer review, the contractors sawing and drilling and banging nails back at the house, talking about Afghanistan, and he is astonished at how quickly and imperceptibly this has happened, suddenly feels like discussing a recently watched, emotionally drenching film whose effects are beginning to wane. The week proves one of the hardest of his professional career. Though he had meant to, he doesn't find the time to talk to Joan Schaefer about Roshi. A foul mood takes hold of him all week. He's short with the boys at home, annoyed with the workers streaming in and out of his house and all the noise. His sleep pattern has yet to return to normal. He receives 2 more emails from Amra. More updates on the conditions in Kabul. Rabia Balkhi, the women's hospital, has reopened. Karzai's cabinet will allow cable television networks to broadcast programs, challenging the Islamic hardliners who had opposed it.
in a postscript at the end of the second email. She says that Roshi had become withdrawn since he left, and asks again whether he has spoken to his chief. He steps away from the keyboard. He returns to it later, ashamed of how Amro's note had irritated him. How tempted he had been, for just a moment, to answer her in capital letters. I will, in due time.
I hope that went okay for you.
Joan Schaefer sits behind her desk, hands laced in her lap. She is a woman of cheerful energy, with a full face and coarse white hair. She peers at him over the narrow reading glasses perched on the bridge of her nose. You understand, the point was not to impugn you.
Yes, of course, Idris says. I understand.
And don't feel bad, it could happen to any of us. CHF and pneumonia on X-ray? Sometimes it's hard to tell.
Thanks, June.
He gets up to go, pauses at the door.
Oh, something I've been meaning to discuss with you.
Sure, sure, sit.
He sits down again. He tells her about Roshi, describes the injury, the lack of resources at Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital. He confides in her the commitment he has made to Amra and Roshi, saying it aloud. He feels weighed down by his promise in a way he had not done in Kabul, standing in the hallway with Amra when she has kissed his cheek. He is troubled to find that it feels like buyer's remorse.
My God, Idris, Joan says, shaking her head. I commend you, but how dreadful, that poor child. I can't imagine.
I know, he says. He asks if the group would be willing to cover her procedure.
Or procedures, my sense is she will need more than one.
Joan sighs.
I wish, but frankly, I doubt the board of the directors would approve it, Idris. I doubt it very much. You know we have been in the red for the last 5 years, and there would be legal issues as well, complicated ones.
She waits for him, maybe prepared for him to challenge this, but he doesn't.
I understand, he says.
You should be able to find a humanitarian group that does this sort of thing, no? It would take some work, but...
I look into it. Thanks, John.
He gets up again, surprised that he is feeling lighter, almost relieved by her response. The home theater takes another month to be built, but it is a marvel. The picture, shot from the projector mounted on the ceiling, is sharp. The movements on the 102-inch screen strikingly fluid. The 7.1-channel surround sound, the graphic equalizers, and the bass traps they have put in the four corners have done wonders for the acoustics. They watch Pirates of the Caribbean, the boys delighted by the technology, sitting on either side of him, eating from the communal bucket of popcorn on his lap. They fall asleep before the final, drawn-out battle scene. I put them to bed, Idris says to Nail. He lifts one, then the other. The boys are growing, their lean bodies lengthening with alarming speed. As he tucks each into bed, an awareness sets in of the heartbreaks that is in store for him with his boys. In a year, two at the outside, he will be replaced. The boys will become enamored with other things, other people, embarrassed by him and Nahil. Idris thinks longingly of when they were small and helpless, so wholly dependent on him. He remembers how terrified Zabi was of manholes when he was little, walking wide, clumsy circles around them. Once watching an old film, Lamar had asked Idris if he had been alive back when the world was in black and white. The memory brings a smile. He kisses his son's cheeks. He sits back in the dark, watching Lamar sleep. He had judged his boys hastily, he sees now, and unfairly. And he had judged himself harshly too. He's not a criminal. Everything he owns, he has earned.
in the 90s, while half the guys he knew were out clubbing and chasing women, he had been buried in study, dragging himself through hospital corridors at 2 in the morning, foregoing leisure, comfort, sleep. He had given his 20s to medicine. He has paid his dues. Why should he feel badly? This is his family. This is his life. In the last month, Roshi has become something abstract to him, like a character in a play. Their connection has frayed. The unexpected intimacy he had stumbled upon in that hospital, so urgent and acute, has eroded into something dull. The experience has lost its power. He recognizes the fierce determination that has seized him for what it really was, an illusion, a mirage. He had fallen under the influence of something like a drug. The distance between him and the girl feels vast now. It feels infinite, insurmountable, and his promise to her misguided, a reckless mistake, a terrible misreading of the measures of his own powers and will and character. Something best forgotten. He is incapable of it. It is that simple. In the last 2 weeks, he has received 3 more emails from Amrao. He read the first and didn't answer. He deleted the next 2 without reading. The line in the bookstore is about 12 or 13 people long. It stretches from the makeshift stage to the magazine stand. A tall, broad-faced woman passes out little yellow post-its to those in line to write their names on and any personal message they want inscribed in the book. A saleswoman at the head of the line helps people flip to the title page. Idris is near the head of the line, holding a copy in his hand. The woman in front of him, in her 50s and with short, clipped, blonde hair, turns and says to him, "Have you read it?" "No," he says. "We are going to read it for our book club next month. It's my turn to pick." "Oh," she frowns and pushes a palm against her chest. "I hope people read it. It's such a moving story, so inspiring. I bet they make it a movie." It's true what he told her. He has not read the book and doubts he ever will. He does not think he has the stomach to revisit himself on its pages. But others will read it, and when they do, he will be exposed. People will know. Nahil, his sons, his colleagues. He feels sick at the thought of it. He opens the book again, flips past the acknowledgments, past the bio of the co-author, who has done the actual writing. He looks again at the photo on the book flap. There is no sign of the injury. If she bears a scar, which she must, the long, wavy black hair conceals it. Roshi is wearing a blouse with little gold beads, an Allah necklace, lapis ear studs. She's leaning against a tree, looking straight at the camera, smiling. He thinks of the stick figures she had drawn him. "Don't go. Don't leave, Kaka." He does not detect in this young woman even a scrap of the tremulous little creature he had found behind the curtain 6 years before. Idris glances at the dedication page. "To the 2 angels in my life, my mother Amra and my Kaka Timur, you are my saviors. I owe you everything." The line moves. The woman with the short blonde hair gets her book signed. She moves aside, and Idris, heart stammering, steps forward. Roshi looks up. She is wearing an Afghan shawl over a pumpkin-colored long, steep blouse, and little oval-shaped silver earrings. Her eyes are darker than he remembers, and her body is filling out with female curves. She looks at him without blinking, and though she gives no overt indication that she has recognized him, and though her smile is polite, there is something amused and distant about her expression. Playful, sly,
unintimidated.
It steamrolls him, and suddenly all the words that he had composed, even written down, rehearsed in his head on the way here, dry up.
He cannot bring himself to say a thing. He can only stand there, looking vaguely foolish.
The sales clerk clears her throat.
Sir, if you give me your book, I will flip it to the title page, and Roshi will autograph it for you.
The book?
Idris looks down, finds it clutched tightly in his hands.
He has not come here to get it signed, of course.
That would be galling, grotesquely galling, after everything.
Still, he sees himself handing it over. The sales clerk expertly flipping to the correct page.
Roshi's hand scrawling something beneath the title. He has seconds left now to say something. Not that it would mitigate the indefensible, but because he thinks he owes it to her. But when the clerk hands him back his book, he cannot summon the words. He wishes now for even a scrap of Timur's courage. He looks again at Roshi. She is already gazing past him at the next person in line.
I am... he begins.
We have to keep the line moving now, sir,
the clerk says. He drops his head and leaves the queue. He has parked in the lot behind the store. The walk to the car feels like the longest of his life. He opens the car door, pauses before entering. With hands that have not stopped shaking, he flips the book open again. The scrawling is not a signature. In English, she has written him two sentences. He closes the book, his eyes too. He supposes he should be relieved, but part of him wishes for something else. Perhaps if she had grimaced at him, said something infantile, full of loathing and hate, an eruption of rancor, perhaps that might have been better. Instead, a clean diplomatic dismissal. And this note.
Don't worry, you're not in it.
An act of kindness. Perhaps, more accurately, an act of charity. He should be relieved, but it hurts. He feels the blow of it, like an axe to the head.
There is a bench nearby, beneath an elm tree. He walks over and leaves the book on it. He returns to the car and sits behind the wheel. And it is a while before he trusts himself to turn the key and drive away.
Chapter 6, February 1974. Editor's note. Parallax 84. Winter 1974. Page 5. Dear readers, 5 years ago, when we began our quarterly issues, featuring interviews with little-known poets, we could not have anticipated how popular they would prove. Many of you asked for more, and indeed, your enthusiastic letters paved the way for these issues to become an annual tradition here at Parallax. The profiles have now become our staff writers' personal favorites as well. The features have led to the discovery or rediscovery of some valuable poets and an overdue appreciation of their work. Sadly, however, a shadow hovers over this present issue. The artist featured this quarter is Nila Vahdati, an Afghan poet, interviewed by Etienne Boustoulet last winter in the town of Courbevoie near Paris. Madame Vahdati, as we are sure you will agree, gave Monsieur Boustoulet one of the most revealing and startlingly frank interviews we have ever published. It was with great sadness that we learned of her untimely death not long after this interview was conducted. She will be missed in the community of poets. She survived by her daughter. It's uncanny, the timing. The elevator door dings open at precisely the same moment the phone begins to ring. Parry can hear the ringing because it comes from inside Julian's apartment, which is at the head of the narrow, barely lit hallway and therefore closest to the elevator. Intuitively, she knows who's calling. By the look on Julian's face, so does he. Julian, who has already stepped into the elevator, says, "Let it ring."